Hello and welcome to Cricket Visit the World Cup, the first of a series of spaces that we will be doing throughout the Cricket World Cup, where a week into the tournament, every team's played at least once, and there have already been plenty of talking points to get stuck into on an analytical level. We've seen the champions get humbled in Ahmedabad, World Cup records tumbling in Delhi, and two of the game's heavyweights play out a crazy low-scoring affair in Chennai last night. I'm Patrick Noon, and joining me once again to talk about all of that and more, and to look ahead to the next round of matches is Ben Jones, Head of Insight at CricViz, and James Norton Brown, our head data scientist. So we're going to start with the opening match in Ahmedabad when England, the defending champions, were rolled over by New Zealand by 9 wickets. Ben, what went wrong with the bat?
Quite a lot. It was a very, very odd night for England for a number of reasons. We've grown used to, through the 2015 to 2019 cycle of watching England just kind of churn out, 320, 350, 400, occasionally even more. And that kind of like machine-like consistency hasn't really had opportunity to be the case over the last 4 years because of COVID and scheduling, etc. So we weren't quite sure what performances we were going to see from England in this World Cup with the bat. But I don't think any of us thought we were going to see that performance on opening night. It was underpowered. England didn't really... didn't really throw a punch, to be honest. There were a couple of moments where they started to get into gear, but it was one of the few times I think I've seen England play and register a lower attacking shot percentage than the opposition. And it just was a disjointed performance. Obviously, they got off to a reasonable start. Darragh Milan went nicked off early, but Johnny Bairstow found a bit of fluency while the field was up. New Zealand maybe bowled a little bit full with the new ball. But then things just started to unravel. Bairstow kind of guides one inside out to the man in the deep. And then everything just seems to kind of, a kind of nervousness infected the English order, I think. There were poor decisions all the way through. New Zealand picked this really odd side, which batted incredibly deep, but relied on 20 overs from the all-rounders, from the kind of part-time bowlers, if you're being slightly disrespectful. And I think England should have really just seen that as a massive opportunity, see off Bolt, Henry and Santner, and then go hard against the spare bowlers. But they didn't really get the opportunity. Every time they tried to lay a glove on those bowlers, they would make a mistake. Moeen Ali gets out to Glenn Phillips, and then Phillips is immediately whipped at the attack. And then Bolt and Root have to kind of do this rebuild job. And then at the end, when Phillips comes back on, Root does a little weird little reverse sweep thing. And I think those two shots kind of sum up the whole proceedings, really. It was a lot of poor decision making, and I think the one that was let on was Harry Brooks' attempted devastation of Rajan Ravindra with the ball when he was following a lot of drag downs, and Brook goes ridiculously hard and then ends up holding out to the man in the deep. And I think that is, to an extent, a bit more of what we probably wanted to see from England. A little bit more, we're just going to score 10 more than you. And so I feel like Brooks deserves a little bit more credit than he's maybe been given. But all in all, it was a very odd, unpleasant innings for England. And they obviously stumbled away to 282 with a bit of a last-minute partnership from Rashid and Wood. And at half-time, probably thought it was something of an even game, but it turned out to be very much not.
Yeah, I think broadly it just seemed like a lot of England batters weren't really got out by New Zealand bowlers. But as you say, Root played a weird shot. Wokes, I know he's not there primarily for his batting, but his dismissal against Santner was pretty poor as well. And so, yeah, they came in pretty under par. And then if you're, well, maybe slightly under par, it felt at the time. But yeah, I think we should probably give some credit to New Zealand. Obviously, like Santner bowled beautifully, didn't he, James?
Yeah, absolutely. He sort of varied his speeds in a way that I can't really remember. I think he's going to do it. He bowled 40% of deliveries. 50% of deliveries below 80 kilometres an hour, 30% of deliveries above 90 kilometres an hour. He sort of didn't bowl the traditional speed of a finger spinner. He bowled slow deliveries that would sort of grip and turn, and then fast deliveries sort of get through the batter. Really, the pitch actually wasn't offering as much as it, as we saw in the second innings. The pitch really wasn't offering much for the spinner. He sort of created that sort of indecision in the batters through his variation in speed. You sort of saw that with the Bairstow dismissal, where he sort of held it up a bit, and then with the the Wokes dismissal, where he sort of also got in court. He was really creating doubt in the batter's minds with his speed, with his lengths. I thought he bowled brilliantly. And I think also Latham just captained really, really aggressively. I think he brought on his bowlers at the right time. England then sort of were in a bit of a middle ground where they weren't quite sure whether or not to attack the bowlers that were bowling to them in the middle. So it was obviously, I think in their head, they probably thought that Bolton particularly was going to be safe for the death, and they could therefore attack through the middle overs. But what they were seeing in reality is Santner bowling a lot through the middle overs, Bolt bowling a lot through the middle overs, Henry coming back on aggressively through the middle overs. So they were sort of caught in that in-between space, whether to attack in the phase they thought they needed to attack it, or whether to attack the bowlers they thought they needed to attack. And so that's sort of, I think maybe those shots you saw that we were talking about earlier were sort of caught in that middle ground between not quite sure what you're doing in terms of, is this a bowler in a situation we want to attack in or not? And I think that 30 to 40 over phase just before the fifth fielder goes out is going to be really, really interesting. I just think India didn't quite get it right in this game.
I think it's potentially overanalyzing it to kind of go too hard on it. But I think what could be really interesting about this as an example is that we've spoken a lot about how T20 cricket has affected ODI cricket. It's higher scores, it's more aggression. But the opportunity to maybe front load your bowlers and basically say, we are going to try and bowl these guys who don't necessarily have the most resilient techniques or aren't used to the tempo of ODI cricket. We're going to basically give you 35 to 40 overs of absolutely gun bowling. And if you can make it through that, then fair play. You can have your fun at the end against the part-time bowlers. It's just this like ultra aggressive approach that kind of feels quite tailored to the kind of the current state of the ODI game, which I think could be really interesting if other teams follow suit. You know, it's very easy for, you know, if Jimmy Neesham's bowling at the death to a set Joss Butler and Ben Stokes, that's one thing. But if those guys aren't there because they've been dismissed by some fantastic bowling from Bolt and Saudi Bolt and Henry, who have already been used their allocation, then suddenly Neesham at the death becomes a far less risky proposition. I think it's a really interesting, not necessarily trend, because it's one game, not enough to draw a straight line, but it'll be interesting to see whether teams adopt that approach with this current landscape.
Yeah, and then so once England had posted, as I say, a slightly below par score as it felt at the time, we knew they needed to bowl well, and with maybe a notable exception, Sam Curran, who started with two maidens, they didn't bowl particularly well, did they? I think Wokes in particular, having watched Henry and Bolt sort of show how to bowl on that surface, he sort of got quite a lot all wrong, didn't he, James?
Yeah, absolutely. Only so if you look at sort of good line, good length deliveries, which is sort of what you'd be looking for on that pitch, what New Zealand did so well on that pitch, he only bowled 40% of balls on a good line and good length. Now, the other three bowlers who took the new ball were all above 50%. Wokes' expected average was also 59 for his opening spell, which is the worst of any spell for a decade from him. So, like, I don't think it was a plan thing. I don't think it was a strategy thing. I think he just had a bad day. Bowled poorly, bowled straight too full, straight too short. It felt like he couldn't find his length, couldn't find his line, and really got punished by the opening batters. I thought Conway was just, you know, brilliant, but I think you have to get Conway early. Otherwise, it's just such a struggle, particularly with, you know, without the spin options through the middle overs that England lacks. I think Wokes just struggled, and I think it just sort of set the whole team off, particularly defending a below par total. It just sort of set the whole innings off on a poor note, and I think they really struggled to get back.
I think what was particularly interesting with Wokes is that obviously England have grown so used to him just being completely consistent and reliable at the top of the innings, and so they don't really have to do much planning, you know, kind of crisis planning of what happens if Wokes gets capped, because he just doesn't. And even when he does, it's normally because someone's come really hard, and at which point you're thinking we're creating opportunities. Whereas this wasn't that. I don't think New Zealand particularly came out to go all guns blazing, but Wokes almost invited them on by the fact that he really wasn't on his game. It felt like England kind of walked onto a right hook. You know, at halftime it felt even, and then within 10 overs it felt like the game was completely gone. I think the knock-ons from Wokes struggling were really interesting. Obviously England went with just the three seamers, and that kind of put them into a bit of a corner, because all of a sudden Wokes was essentially at that point unbowlable. They had to take him out of the attack. Now, they could have turned to spin if they wanted to, but they didn't want to use Rashid early, I think rightly, because they want to kind of hold him back to exploit any early inroads they do make. And Moeen Ali's not necessarily the best option to Devon Conway, who is, remarkably for a left-hander, very, very good against off-spin. So they turn to Mark Wood, who's not really a power play one bowler. He's not. It's not really his skill set, you know, for all of the many, many skills and attributes that he does have. It's not really his phase. And particularly in the way that he bowled very, very short, because there was so much momentum with Ravindra and Conway that it felt like England were almost having to go to a, geez, let's just take some risks and try and, you know, almost like buy a wicket. And it doesn't really work in power play one, that approach, when you've only got two men out. You know, I think in the last few years, short balls in the power play in the first 10 overs averaged 38 in ODI cricket. Now, granted, not everyone who's bowling those balls is bowling them at the pace that Mark Wood is. But it just shows how the extreme to which England were pushed really, really early on. it kind of drew everything out of place. It was almost like they'd been dragged out of position. It meant that Wood, who is obviously primarily a kind of middle overs enforcer, then couldn't really operate it in that phase, and they had to turn to the part-time spin. Sam Curran's far more of a new ball bowler, but England had to kind of use him a little bit more in the middle. It dragged everyone out of position, and it made New Zealand's fantastic batting, which it was, because I think they, to an extent, also hit England off their length fantastically. Conway, I think, struck at 133 against good length deliveries. Across the day, I think those balls went at about 40. So he really did kind of force England into these changes. But it just felt very, very quickly like England didn't really have an answer. And I think partly that was because of the structure of the side with only Curran, Wokes and Wood to offer the seam options. It meant that there wasn't very much flexibility. And I think we're going to talk in a second about what that means for the rest of the tournament and the next game in particular. But it's certainly kind of like food for thought for the think tank.
Yeah, absolutely. Since that game, New Zealand have already won again. They played tonight, beating the Netherlands fairly comfortably. It looked like by 99 runs. We didn't see that game. We were flying from Chennai to Delhi. So we'll do a proper roundup of that in the next show we do. But for England, next up, they've got Bangladesh in Dharamsala. This becomes a pretty big game now. James, you saw Bangladesh beat Afghanistan at Dharamsala. Do you think that the conditions there will suit England a bit better than Ahmedabad?
Definitely. We saw a lot of swing in that game, the most swing of any game in the competition so far. But interestingly, while Shoaiful looked very threatening in the power play and it'll be a real threat for England to have to deal with, Bangladesh really won that game in the middle overs with their spinners, with Mehedi and Shakib, who are two absolute quality operators through the middle. But interestingly, the pitch didn't actually offer that much turn. They were sort of deceiving them in the flight and possibly Afghanistan's quite poor play through the middle overs. It'll be really interesting to see if Bangladesh's spin attack gets the same amount of joy tomorrow against a higher quality batting lineup. The conditions should suggest that they won't, but obviously they are two of the best finger spinners in the world, so it'll be very interesting to see. That middle overs phase was really crucial in that Bangladesh-Afghanistan game, even though the conditions would suggest that power play would be crucial with the ball. So it'll be interesting to see which one wins out tomorrow.
And Ben, do you think England will make any changes? Obviously, they went with Moeen as well as Rashid in the first game. But do you think there's room for a seamer to come in, maybe Topley or Gus Atkinson?
I think if they pick the same side, they'd still be confident of winning, just because it's a lot of experience and it's a very good 11. But I think given conditions in Dharamsala, as James has outlined, I think bringing in Rhys Topley, particularly to exploit that swing that we saw in the Bangladesh-Afghanistan game, I think would make sense. And I think it would also make sense for Moeen Ali to drop out. Bangladesh have got lots of threats and they can hurt England, but they're unlikely to just outgun them with the bat and put a score on the board that is out of England's reach. So I think going with a slightly shallower batting lineup and a slightly stronger bowling lineup is probably the way to go, just to really try and exploit the conditions and try and get around that problem that England have, where they had no flexibility with the seamers in terms of when and where they were used. I think having four and two, as we spoke about in the preview, is a really valuable asset in certain conditions in India. And I think that moving to that formation would give England a better chance of just kind of keeping a lid on Bangladesh's potential to spring a bit of a surprise.
Yeah, and if they do spring a surprise, then England will really be in trouble. That according to our, or rather James's qualification prediction model, their chances will drop to 25% should Bangladesh come out on top in that one. Elsewhere, yesterday we saw India beat Australia in a low-scoring affair at Chennai. They ran out winners by six wickets. This was a slight bit of a throwback, this game, wasn't it? It was quite a tough pitch to bat on. Australia struggled their way to 199. And then, despite a little scare early on when they reduced India to 2 for 3, it's a pretty comfortable win for India in the end. Ben, what did you make of the way Australia went about that batting?
I think it was a really, really interesting game. I don't think it was necessarily the most enthralling context, but from a kind of tactical perspective, at the start of a tournament, where you're trying to pick up on trends and see what teams are going to try and set themselves up to do, I think it was really interesting. We've seen Australia be so aggressive in the power play in the first 10 overs over the last 18 months or so. And partly that's when they've been at full strength with Travis Head kind of going all guns blazing. But Mitch Marsh isn't exactly a kind of shrinking violet. But what we saw yesterday was, you know, on a stinking hot day in Chennai, it was absolutely baking. You know, we were in the commentary box and
the aircon was running overtime. It was not a pleasant day, and I can understand completely why Australia chose to bat first and avoid bowling in the hot sun. But they came out and they batted very, very timidly early on. They had none of that early aggression. Bumrah was outstanding with the new ball, which I think, obviously, these things don't happen in a vacuum. Australia were responding to what they were facing, but they didn't really lay a glove on them. And Mitch Marsh didn't look comfortable. Siraj was getting good movement as well. He was a little bit looser than Bumrah, but he was getting good movement, as we've seen. And it kind of set the tone. There were a couple of early wickets. There was a slightly limp dismissal for David Warner. Smith and Labuschagne were kind of tasked with rebuilding the innings, but there was no innovation. There was no kind of urgency, which to an extent is understandable. I think 250 was probably maybe a winning score, certainly a more defendable score in a more orthodox way. But there was never really a sense of how can we get above that? How can we work above par? I think there was an argument for maybe promoting Glenn Maxwell above Marnus Labuschagne, obviously pushes Marnus out of position. But this was a pitch I think where you needed to play in quite an unorthodox way in order to score quickly. I know James has got the numbers and conditions, but it wasn't necessarily a classic turning Chennai wicket. I know Jadeja bowled a couple of absolute gun deliveries, particularly to get rid of Smith, I think. And it did turn on occasion, but in general, it was the stoppiness of the wicket. It was slow. It was inconsistent. The bounce was inconsistent. It was a strange wicket rather than just an orthodox bouncer. And yeah, that's good. We want to see variety of conditions. You come to Chennai, I don't want to see a road. I want to see a turning wicket. But I think Australia they lacked flexibility. They lacked kind of any kind of creativity with how they were going to go about their innings. They played a straightforward day, and as a result, got an underpowered score that at half time, I think we all thought, you know, there's a game on if Australia, for instance, take 3 wickets for 2 runs. I just don't think anyone particularly thought that was going to happen.
Yeah, I think part of that is when you think of Australia and you think about sort of what we were talking about before, talking about how they're going to win games. You think about them trying to win the game with the bat. And I think this line, the 11 they picked isn't really the 11 you would pick to do that. Sort of a 4-5 of Labuschagne and Carey isn't really what I would imagine when I was, you know, envisioning this Australia side 6 months ago. Obviously, some of that is the head injury. But they sort of decided to go to their bowling heavy approach, vindicating in some ways they bowled very well. But that's part of the reason why they lack that intent at the top order. You sort of have Cummins at 8, Stark 9. Green looks pretty much all at sea in terms of at the moment with the bat on these types of pitches. And Carey just doesn't give them that left-hander that they want. He's pretty terrible against slow left-arm spin. Just doesn't insulate them from Jadeja in the way that a left-hander should be through the middle overs. They just, Labuschagne, but they sort of set up to just score 250 and then try to defend it. And then they seem to get caught in the middle and not quite get there, even there. They just weren't very, they were a bit stodgy. They didn't really have that pace, the explosiveness down the bottom of the order. And they just seemed very reliant on Maxwell. I'd be somewhat surprised if we don't see Stoinis come back in for the next game. I think they need somebody else in that batting lineup to give them some sort of power, because they just looked a little bit underpowered, which is not how they've been trying to win cricket games over the last 6 months. So it was somewhat surprising to see them shape up like that.
Yeah, and then when they got ball in hand, they did obviously make those early inroads. They did reduce to 2 for 3, Rohit and Shreyas going early, along with Kishan and the first over. That dragged their win vis back from, it was, I think it was about 79% in favour of India at the interval, and that got it about 50-50. But then, James, you've got some stats on what was probably the turning point in the whole game about when Mitch Marsh dropped Virat Kohli, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, obviously, an absolutely incredible start. You sort of saw Hazelwood just banging away on a good length. Stark coming in, steaming in, always getting making that risk of that first over. Kishan probably playing a pretty loose shot. Shreyas Iyer playing one of the most confusing shots I've seen, sort of a flap and a wide one from Hazelwood. It was very, very unusual. It seemed like the pressure was sort of getting to them both. But then Kohli came in. It looked like everything was settling down. And at the end of the power play, sort of skews one high. At that point, Winvis was 50-50. If Marsh catches that ball on Winvis, it would have gone to 70% Australia, 30% India. It would have been an absolute huge moment in the game. You know, it brings Harlech to the crease early. India don't back particularly deep, even with Ashwin at 8. Really would have thrown the game wide open. But, you know, obviously he drops the catch. And then from there, KL and Kohli sort of made it look quite comfortable.
Yeah, I think KL in particular batted like he was on a different pitch compared to, well, certainly compared to the Australia batters. Ben, what did you make of that? I don't know, he looked sort of gutted at the end when he tried to hit a four and accidentally hit a six, which kind of sums up the kind of form he was in.
Yeah, it's a problem I think we've all had at various points in our cricketing careers, obviously. I've accidentally hit Pat Cummins inside out for six over cover. It was a cracking innings. I think he played really well. I think Kohli will get a few more plaudits, obviously, because he is like the chase master, and this is, you know, another one in his copybook. But I think KL was the real master of this, obviously. Didn't get dropped and didn't get out, most importantly. I think he played the kind of innings that he is in the side to produce at number five. You know, we've spoken a lot about India in other formats, white ball cricket, of erring on the side of caution and erring on the side of having too many anchors, in inverted commas, in the side. And I think in ODI cricket, that debate is just so much less. You can afford to have a few more guys who are a little bit stodgier when they've got gears like KL Rahul. When KL wants to go, he can go. We've seen that in the IPL for years now. He is a fantastically talented batter. And when he comes in and the score is 2 for 3, he can also have the Red Bull technique, that kind of low heartbeat cricket, to just nudge it around and to play a kind of calm tempo that just takes the sting out of the game. And we saw that, you know, Chennai was bouncing after that drop. You know, it was there was so much tension in the air, there was so much kind of feeling in the air, to kind of just put that to one side and just knock the ball around and to keep it calm. And then as the opportunity comes in to go for the kill when you're on, you know, 17 not out and basically everyone's done, you charge through and you try and finish it quickly. And that is what he did. He could have finished it quickly if he'd have gone 4-6. There would have been a better boost to that run rate than if he'd just gone 6. I'm sure that was what he was thinking about. But I think it was just a really, really impressive example of why India are just so difficult to roll. Australia basically had the perfect first 10 overs or first 5 overs. They were immaculate. Hazelwood was basically, that was perfect. If he could do that every game, he'd be the greatest ODI bowler of all time in the first 10 overs. He was perfect. Stark, we know how good he is. And yet, even that wasn't enough to get rid of these solid, dynamic players who can take the game away from you. I think that's going to be a real asset for India going forward, that they just don't... Indian fans take the mick out of each other and themselves about, you know, the 5 for 3 and the semi-final, all this kind of stuff. But I don't think that's going to be a problem as much as it was before, because you're not talking about an experienced number five. You're talking about KL Rahul, who's done it in all formats, who, as we saw yesterday, is up there with the best when he's on form.
Yeah, and I think part of that, obviously Australia were brilliant in the power play and India were fabulous through the middle, but I think Australia were disappointing in the middle overs. Zampa was poor. He sort of didn't target the stumps. He didn't really spin the ball. All three India spinners got more spin, more purchase off the surface than Zampa. Obviously, you know, Jadeja's familiar with those conditions, and in general, Kuldeep does give the ball a rip, but Zampa didn't really target the stumps. His hitting the stumps percentage was lower than any other spinner, and he didn't spin the ball very much and just couldn't seem to find his length or his line very well. Obviously, Maxwell, he doesn't really spin it, so it's not surprising that he didn't get much turn, but it was always more of a containing option to right-hand batters than an aggressive option, and they just didn't seem to really be able to take a wicket in that middle overs. They went back to start very early to try to find some reverse, sort of sacrificing those deck at death. It was probably good captaincy, but... Just a little bit toothless in the middle overs. We weren't expecting with Zampa. I mean, just if he bowls like this, they are going to struggle through the competition. This was a very friendly surface. Two right-hand batters who were very good against leg spin, but should be able to get into a bit of a groove. And he just bowled quite poorly. He bowled a bit too short. KL Rahul was brutal at cutting him. He just didn't really, you know, be the threat that everyone thought he was going to be when he came to the attack.
I just want to jump in very quickly off that, James. I think you're absolutely bang on. I don't think it was Zampa's finest night by any stretch of the imagination. But I do think that it was a slight indication. We spoke earlier about Latham's very aggressive captaincy. It felt like Cummins was a slightly too conservative, slightly too reactive. He's not got huge experience as an ODI captain. And I think it showed, because there was an opportunity to get Zampa into the attack early when these two guys were getting set. And obviously the seamers were running riot, so you don't want to jump the gun too early. But I think there was a missed opportunity there. And then suddenly, as you say, once those guys are in, they are two of the best players to spin in the world in ODI cricket. And I think that as a result, it doesn't matter what pitch you're bowling on, if you're slightly off your game against KL and Virat, that you are going to get punished. And I think Cummins didn't necessarily give Zampa the biggest opportunity to succeed in that particular game.
Yeah, I think that's completely fair. And I think that probably links in with the New Zealand game and also the South African game we'll talk about in a minute. It seems like a big theme to look for as this World Cup moves forward is these batters in the middle overs, once they get set, once they're in, it's very hard to dislodge them. Like the ability to threaten wickets in the middle overs is a really, really difficult skill in ODI cricket. And batters cashing in through the middle overs, bowlers being able to take wickets, is why Kuldeep is so important for India. The ability to threaten and take wickets in the middle overs is so difficult. And the counter to that is batters have to cash in when they get in. So I think it's going to be a really interesting thing for this World Cup.
Indeed. Plenty to think about for Australia. Their next opponents are South Africa, who got off to a flyer by beating Sri Lanka by 102 runs in Delhi. That was a record-breaking match. They hit the highest first innings total in World Cups, and Aidan Markram hit the fastest hundreds in World Cups, surpassing Kevin O'Brien's effort against England from 2011 by one ball. Ben, you were quite impressed by that knock, I think, understandably.
Yeah, you'd be a bit inhuman not to be. I'm a massive fan of Markram and have been for a long time. I remember watching him in the 2018 Test Series against Australia, which I think was remembered for other reasons, but he made a quite remarkable century in that series, and I've kind of been obsessed with him a little bit ever since. I think that his evolution into a white ball gun has been fascinating. Given that his main issues early on were against spin, he really struggled against spin when he first came into ODI cricket, and he's a classic South African batter, brilliant against pace, but actually he struggled for a long time in terms of having aggression against pace. He struggled to kind of get strike rate up in ODI cricket and T20 cricket as well. But he's worked on it over the last couple of years, particularly since COVID, since 2020. And suddenly he's got gears against everyone. He can bat a number 4 or 5 in the IPL and smack the spinners around, but he can also face the highest pace bowlers in the world and have a pretty solid average of, I think, just under 40 with a decent strike rate. And that's kind of what we saw on Saturday, I think. It was just that he can do it against anyone. 49 ball century is probably, he's never going to better that. Very few people are. But what we also saw was the rounded element to his game, that he did that whilst also barely giving a chance. 3% false shots. I think there have only been two more secure World Cup centuries in terms of by that measure. And one of them being AB against West Indies in 2015, which I think is obviously one of the most iconic ODI knocks of all time. It just felt like a bit of an arrival. This is a guy who's been kind of the next big thing for a long, old time. And I know it's not necessarily the most consequential game, and I know that there's far bigger tests to come. But in that middle order, alongside Klaassen, alongside Miller, alongside Rassie van der Dussen, that is an absolutely gun middle order that suddenly South Africa are talking about, thinking, geez, we could win the World Cup with this top six. And I think Markram is the guy who's probably improved the most in recent years to kind of stand alongside those other guys.
Yeah, and the thing that struck me at watching this game was the conditions. I think coming into this, we were talking about Delhi, thinking it was going to be a bit of a struggle for batters, like based on the IPL and recent games that have been played there. But I mean, in Sri Lanka's response, they hit what at the time was the second highest total of the tournament. They just happened to be doing it against the first highest total of the tournament. This was an absolute road, wasn't it, James?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the key metrics in terms of determining how good a pitch is what we call bouncing consistency. So basically how true the bounce is. It doesn't necessarily need to be high bounce or low bounce, but if it's bouncing consistently, batters know what to do. They know how to plan for it, and they hit it pretty consistently. And this was, in the lower 4% of, one of the truest bouncing pitches we've seen in a very, very long time in ODI cricket. It was basically a road, and it didn't take much spin. Didn't seem to do a lot off the deck. It was just a very, very flat pitch. Like, spinners got hit, pacers got hit. If the Delhi pitches stay like this all tournament, then I think batters will be very happy because it's a very small ground thing with Delhi, and that's why you get such volatile scores at that ground, is because that sort of ground profile where you've got a bit of a tacky surface but a tiny ground leads to such volatility. Because if the pitch is true, the runs you can score are just immense, and that's sort of what we saw in this game. It'll be very interesting to see if it continues. Delhi has a bit of a history for pretty inconsistent pitches ground by ground. So, this could be a road, but that's no guarantee that the one they play at next isn't. But I think if it can stay this true, I think we'll see a lot of very high scores in this game.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I think, it was a bit of a surprise. I think it's worth mentioning that the pitch in the square was relayed ahead of this tournament, which kind of can go either way, I guess. You can end up with it being sort of fresh and, when the ground's not bedded in properly, it can be sort of hard to bat again. But this went the other way. And yeah, it was, as I say, even Sri Lanka looked like they were enjoying themselves batting out there. Obviously, it was such a high total that they didn't get that close. But Ben, you were quite impressed with what you saw from some of their guys.
Yeah, I think it's one of those days where when you concede 400 plus, you can kind of wilt and lose to a degree which almost feels like two defeats with the net run rate hit. And you know, they lost by 100 runs. This wasn't a close game, but they gave it a lot more of a go than I think we all expected. I think in particular the start of the innings, they were 94 for 2 after 10 overs. I think that's Sri Lanka's sixth highest score at that stage of an innings ever in ODI cricket. This is a team that made their name in the 90s for being extremely off the top. So it was a serious effort, particularly from Kusal Mendes. I think it was really interesting to see him kind of just go out. I was lucky enough to work with him a little bit at Pretoria Capitals at the start of the year, and obviously at a Capitals grind, maybe there was a little bit of that fused into his performance. But he was extremely aggressive then, playing on a very, very true surface that was very, very similar to what we saw in Delhi. And I think, given conditions, Sri Lankan batters who are often used to playing on slightly, spinner-friendly surfaces, if they are put in a situation where they can go hard and they can trust the bounce in the way that James says they can, looking at our models, they do have the technique and the ability and more importantly, for the rest of the tournament, the attitude and the willingness to go really hard and make really, really good inroads early on. And I think that it probably slightly raises their ceiling a little bit. If they're going to bat like this with this aggression when they're given the opportunity to, suddenly there's a few more upsets potentially down the line for guys that are coming up against Sri Lanka, because they can go hard, they can make 300, they can make 320 if conditions allow it, essentially. And Sri Lanka was similarly superbly aggressive. And I think that, yeah, there was a lot of positives to take from a 100-run defeat where you concede 420.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, South Africa, their next game is against Australia. And I don't know, will they be concerned at all about their bowling going into that? Like, surely they can't expect Australia to bat quite as poorly as they did against India. So that's going to be a concern for them, isn't it, James?
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, as we've sort of talked about with South Africa before the tournament, their batting is brilliant, but their bowling is a little bit questionable, particularly Jansen. Jansen got pumped in this game, sort of went for 90 runs in 10 overs. Obviously, a lot of that was by Mendes, but Australia have those batters too. And I think what will be really interesting is if they stick with this balance. Obviously, they're moving to Lucknow, so that pitch has been relayed as well. But historically, Lucknow has been a pretty intense spin lane. It's not a particularly good deck, I would say. So it'd be interesting if they bring in Shamsi here. Ngidi, if the pitch is as we're expecting, and is a slow pitch, Ngidi could be pretty threatening. But Jansen has to play because they need the batting. And he wasn't very threatening with new ball, didn't bowl particularly well. And I think that will be a concern. The batting isn't going to score 400 runs every game. I mean, it might do. They are amazing. But you would imagine the batting's not going to score 400 every game. So the bowling will need to be slightly better than this. But they're coming up against a better side. But the batting is brilliant, but I think the bowling needs a little bit to be desired.
Yeah, I think conditions are going to be really interesting for this one. As you mentioned, we expect Lucknow to be a pretty tough place to bat, pretty spin-friendly. But then we thought that about Delhi as well. And both Lucknow and Delhi have been relayed, as you say. So, I mean, Australia struggled in Chennai. This pitch might be similar to that. Ben, do you reckon they're going to have a similar struggle, or will this be different?
I think if South Africa bowl well and pick the right side, then I think it'll be a similar kind of contest. You know, relay pitches do rarely suddenly revolutionise themselves. Delhi is something of an exception in my experience. So I think it'll be foolish for Australia to assume they're going to walk into a road here. And I just think it's remarkable that, you know, we talk about the way that schedules affect the kind of progress of the tournament, and England's schedule being so backloaded means that they've got kind of a month of jeopardy after the New Zealand defeat, waiting until they play the playoff chances again, the teams who are likely to go through. Whereas Australia have got this really front-loaded schedule where they're playing India and they're playing South Africa, and it feels like they have to kind of hit the ground running. Suddenly, if they lose against South Africa, they are right in it. They are really, really right in it. And it would take a lot to suddenly turn their playoff chances around. So if conditions are even faintly like Chennai, suddenly that day becomes potentially defining in Australia's World Cup. Because if they win, they're going to start to be able to put a string of results together and plot a route to the final. But if they lose, they are really, 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 really up against it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think looking at the qualification model, if they lose, they're down to 30%. But if they win, they're back up to 60%. that's chance of finishing top four. And then also, as you say, the schedule, like after South Africa, they've got Sri Lanka also in luck now. So if it does turn out to be a turner, then they're suddenly facing the likes of Thikshana and Wadalage on what could be a tricky condition. So yeah, it's amazing, even with this format where you play nine matches, how quickly teams can theoretically get into a bit of trouble. But anyway, we mentioned Sri Lanka. They're playing against Pakistan tomorrow in Hyderabad. What do we think is going to happen there? We've already seen Pakistan win reasonably comfortably against the Netherlands. That's a bit of a shaky start with the bat. But yeah, Ben, what did you make of that game? And yeah, what should we expect from that encounter?
Well, I thought the Pakistan-Netherlands game was really interesting because it, you know, ahead of the tournament, we spoke in the preview about how we thought that Netherlands probably wouldn't win a game, but were likely to compete. And I think we saw why in that game, that they have got a really, really good pace attack that can make inroads against good sides and can force mistakes from good batters. You know, the Pakistan top three all kind of subside relatively limply, and it was partly also due to the off spin as well. So there was a sense of like there's a template here for how the Netherlands can compete. There's not quite enough quality throughout the innings for that kind of tension and that pressure to be sustained, as we saw with Pakistan making a really good total. And whilst the Netherlands did put up a good fight in the second innings, and there was a bit of a turning point, it didn't really feel like they were ever going to chase those runs down, if we were all being totally honest. I think the main issue for Pakistan is that their concerns, their big strength is their top order batting, that top four. And obviously Rizwan does okay, but the top three all do struggle in that game against the Dutch. But that was the only area of the game where Sri Lanka's bowling actually stood up. You know, Madushankar bowled really nicely in the first 10 overs against South Africa. He moved the ball, he looked really threatening. And I think that there is an opportunity there for him to really go at Pakistan. You know, they're slightly out of form, these guys. They've churned out runs for a year, for years. And they are clearly extremely good batters, Pakar Emon and Babar. But if Madushankar turns up and does move the ball, there is a real opportunity to put that middle order under pressure again. And it is an inexperienced middle order in terms of the combination they're in. So I think that for me, a big battle is the new ball battle with the ball for Sri Lanka, because that's where they can really, really go hard and lay a glove. And with this newfound batting approach as well, they can maybe chase down, you know, 280, 300 against Pakistan because of this, the greater intent that they showed in that first game, provided the pitch gives them even like a semblance of the same assistance.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think what will be really interesting is the news that Thikshana might be available. I think I'd be very surprised if he doesn't take the new ball in this game. Two left-handers to bowl to. A bit of turn from the Hyderabad pitch, as we've seen. I think that's also... Madushankar's been brilliant. Rajitha's good as well with the new ball. But I think if they can get through that new ball spell by Thikshana, that they'll be in a good position to cash in. Because Sri Lanka don't have like high pace through the middle overs, really. They don't have, you know, a wrist spinner without Hasaranga. It's going to be a real struggle for them if Pakistan can get through that new ball, get through that phase. These balls seem to be getting old very quickly. They can get through sort of that new ball shine, a couple of overs with Thikshana while it's still bouncing and gripping. I think they'll be able to really cash in and make lots of runs. And I think I completely agree with Ben. I think power play for Pakistan with the bat is crucial. And then I think just how Rav goes against Sri Lanka. They haven't got loads of batters who are brilliant against high pace. Kusal Mendes, Kusal Pereira, both quite good. But if you can get through them, then Rav could just run through them in the middle over. So I think they're going to be the two crucial elements tomorrow.
Sorry, I think we lost you there, Pat. I was just going to jump in for one last point, is that, you know, this World Cup, I think, you know, being out here and being in India has been amazing. You know, travelling to a couple of grounds and being there for the opener and India's first game, it's been an amazing experience. And it does feel like, you know, it's nicely paced in terms of the schedule. We've got those back-loaded big games. We've got India-Pakistan coming up. There's a nice even spread of quality and kind of intrigue. But I think what we all really do want is just some really close games now, because we've had some fantastic performances, some individual excellence, and jeopardy in terms of, you know, the holders losing their first game and all this kind of stuff. There's been lots to be excited about. But ultimately, from now, as things start to go into the next 6 weeks, I think we just all want a couple of real nippers, just to kind of get the neutrals on side, get that casual audience flocking around the TV for the last 10 balls. And I think that would... that will take the World Cup to the next level. It's kind of simmering at the moment, but we've not reached boiling point. And hopefully that's what we've got in store over the next week.
Yes, hear. Well said. I think, there's an exciting week coming up. I think, as you say, doubleheader tomorrow, England, Bangladesh, and Pakistan, Sri Lanka. Then it's India again here in Delhi against Afghanistan. And then, that crucial Australia, South Africa game. I think that's just about everything. I think we'll wrap up now, and then not sure exactly when we're going to do another one. Probably next Sunday looks like a good day in the aftermath of the small matter of India v Pakistan. Ben, you and I will both be there. We'll have hopefully some plenty of talking points to go on that one. And we'll see you all soon. Bye.